Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 15th, 2006. Today, we bring you some in-depth looks at the background and responses to the violent situations escalating right now, particularly in the Middle East. Here's what we have coming up for you. After our news, we'll have a focus on Israel and Palestine, with reports from protests for Palestinians in New York, including Orthodox Jews against the occupation. We'll follow that with a talk by an Israeli mother calling for an end to the occupation and a column by Steve Diamond. Our second hour will bring you Media Minutes, Jav Parrish on union activity, and a report about union issues in Mexico. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. Now for news you need to know. From the New York Times on July 14th, Voting Act of 1965 renewed by House. The House of Representatives has voted to renew expiring provisions of the Voting Rights Act after supporters of the landmark civil rights legislation defeated challenges mounted by conservative opponents. The 390-33 vote on Thursday capped a day of impassioned debate that heightened the politically charged atmosphere surrounding race and ethnicity, already aggravated by the recent fight in Congress over immigration. For weeks, the outcome of the battle to extend the act had been in doubt. Republican leaders had planned a vote in June, but they abruptly canceled it after conservative lawmakers objected to several provisions which they said were unnecessary. The rebellion was an embarrassment for the Republican leadership. In early May, House and Senate leaders of both parties had assembled on the steps of the Capitol to pledge their support for the act and celebrate what they described as its imminent approval. To mollify conservatives, House leaders allowed them to offer four amendments Thursday, including one that would have required the Justice Department to demonstrate why the voting procedures in certain states should still be under federal oversight. But in the end, Republicans joined with Democrats to defeat the amendments, allowing both sides to cast themselves as champions of minority voters. The focus now shifts to the Senate, where the Judiciary Committee is expected to take up the measure. On the House floor, many Democrats, as well as Republicans, denounced the amendments offered by conservatives as an effort to derail renewal of the act. Democrats had warned from the start that they would vote against the act if any of the amendments were added. From the Globe and Mail in Canada, Kenneth Lay's death could free Skilling. Kenneth Lay's sudden death could prove an unexpected legal bequest to Jeffrey Skilling, his co-defendant in the landmark Enron Corporation fraud case. That's because Mr. Lay's death effectively voids the entire case against the Enron founder, including the guilty verdict. Mr. Skilling, the former Enron chief executive, who is appealing his own conviction, could now argue that much of the evidence against him stems from a case that no longer exists, argued lawyer Jacob Frenkel, a former federal prosecutor and white-collar crime specialist. Mr. Frenkel said, "This is the first time this has happened in such a high-profile case. Everybody is scrambling to see what the law says on this. How it all plays out could set a legal precedent," he added. Also, federal prosecutors may be stymied in their bid to seize Mr. Lay's assets. From the New York Times on July 7th, "Hate groups are infiltrating the military," group asserts. A decade after the Pentagon declared a zero-tolerance policy for racist hate groups, recruiting shortfalls caused by the war in Iraq have allowed large numbers of neo-Nazis and skinhead extremists to infiltrate the military, according to a watchdog organization. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks racist and right-wing militia groups, estimated that the numbers could run into the thousands, citing interviews with Defense Department investigators and reports and postings on racist websites and magazines. The group quoted a Defense Department investigator as saying, "We've got Aryan Nations graffiti in Baghdad." The center called on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld to appoint a task force to study the problem, declare a new zero-tolerance policy, and strictly enforce it. The report said that neo-Nazi groups like the National Alliance, whose founder, William Pierce, wrote The Turner Diaries, the novel that was the inspiration and blueprint for Timothy McVeigh's bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, sought to enroll followers in the Army to get training for a race war. The report quotes Scott Barfield, a Defense Department investigator, saying, "Recruiters are knowingly allowing neo-Nazis and white supremacists to join the armed forces, and commanders don't remove them from the military even after we positively identify them as extremists." Mr. Barfield said Army recruiters struggled last year to meet goals. Quote, "They don't want to make a big deal, again, about neo-Nazis in the military, because then parents who are already worried about their kids signing up and dying in Iraq are going to be even more reluctant about their kids enlisting if they feel they'll be exposed to gangs and white supremacists," end quote. The report cited accounts by neo-Nazis of their infiltration of the military. An article in the National Alliance magazine, Resistance, urged skinheads to join the Army and insist on being assigned to light infantry units. The author was identified as Stephen Barry, a former Special Forces officer who was the Alliance's military unit coordinator. He wrote, "Light infantry is your branch of choice because the coming race war and ethnic cleansing to follow will be very much an infantryman's war. It will be house to house, neighborhood by neighborhood, until your town or city is cleared and the alien races are driven into the countryside where they can be hunted down and cleansed." He concluded, "As a professional soldier, my goal is to fill the ranks of the United States Army with skinheads." We now bring you a number of international stories focused on the escalating violence in the Middle East. Israel targets Hezbollah in South Beirut. From the Associated Press. Israeli warplanes pounded Hezbollah's South Beirut stronghold and roads around the country, killing at least 15 Lebanese as they fled the onslaught. Hezbollah expanded its rocket fire, hitting another of Israel's main cities. A senior Israeli intelligence official said Iranian troops helped Hezbollah fire a missile that damaged an Israeli warship off the Lebanese coast Friday night. At least 88 people have died in Lebanon, most of them civilians, in the four-day Israeli offensive sparked by Hezbollah's capture of two Israeli soldiers in a cross-border raid. On the Israeli side, at least 15 have been killed, 4 civilians and 11 soldiers. This from Israel Ynet News. Israel gives Syria ultimatum. The London-based Arabic-language newspaper Al-Hayat reported Saturday that Washington has information according to which Israel gave Damascus 72 hours to stop Hezbollah's activity along the Lebanon-Israel border and bring about the release of the two kidnapped IDF soldiers, or it would launch an offensive with disastrous consequences. The report said a senior Pentagon source warned that should the Arab world and international community fail in the efforts to convince Syria to pressure Hezbollah into releasing the soldiers and halt the current escalation, Israel may attack targets in the country. Al-Hayat quoted the source as saying that the U.S. cannot rule out the possibility of an Israeli strike in Syria. The report also mentioned that President George W. Bush has repeatedly put much of the blame for the recent escalation on Syria. The source said that Israel has indicated that it will not end its military activity until a new situation is created that will prevent Syria and Iran from using terror organizations to threaten its security. From Haaretz, Syria says it will support Lebanon, Hezbollah, against Israel. Syria will support Hezbollah and Lebanon against Israel's attacks on the country, the ruling Ba'ath Party said on Friday. A communique from the party's national command issued after a meeting said, "The Syrian people are ready to extend full support to the Lebanese people and their heroic resistance to remain steadfast and confront the barbaric Israeli aggression and its crimes." It said Israel and the United States are trying to wipe out Arab resistance in every land under occupation. Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, said on Friday that Israel would not dare to move against the Islamic Republic, state television reported. Iran has denied Israeli suggestions that Hezbollah guerrillas could take the captured soldiers to Iran. On Thursday, Ahmadinejad said an Israeli strike on Syria would be considered an attack on the whole Islamic world that would bring a fierce response. Ahmadinejad also said it was a must for the organization of the Islamic Conference to become more active regarding the new crisis created by the Zionist regime. From AlJazeera.net and Reuters, UN snubs Lebanese plea. An appeal by Lebanon to the UN Security Council for a ceasefire order against increasingly fierce Israeli raids on its territory has fallen on deaf ears. Nuhad Mahmoud, a Lebanese foreign ministry official, made his plea at an emergency session of the 15-nation council. But members said they planned no immediate action apart from a statement welcoming a decision by the UN Secretary General to send a team to the region to encourage restraint. The U.S. vetoed a resolution on Thursday drafted by Arab nations calling on Israel to end a separate 2-week military incursion in Gaza. Mahmoud said Israel's actions against his country were aimed at bringing Lebanon to its knees and subverting it by any means. He asked the Council to take an immediate and clear decision, calling for a comprehensive, immediate ceasefire, a lifting of the air and sea blockade imposed upon Lebanon, and calling for an end to Israeli aggression. Ibrahim Gambari, the UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, said, "The space for diplomatic initiative is quickly closing." Bush rejects Lebanon's call for ceasefire. From the AP and sfgate.com. President Bush rejected Lebanon's calls for a ceasefire in escalating Mideast violence on Friday, saying only that Israel should try to limit civilian casualties as it steps up attacks on its neighbor. White House spokesman Tony Snow said, "The president is not going to make military decisions for Israel." Lebanon's prime minister asked Bush during a phone call Friday to pressure Israel for a ceasefire, but Bush told him that Israelis have a right to protect themselves. Snow said, "We think it's important that, in doing that, they try to limit as much as possible the so-called collateral damage, not only on civilians, but also on human lives." Israeli warplanes have been bombing sites around Lebanon, including the main airport, bridges, and power stations. At least 61 people in Lebanon have been killed. On the other side, Hezbollah militants have fired hundreds of rockets at northern Israel. At least 10 Israelis have been killed. Hezbollah is an Iranian-backed militant Shiite faction which has a free hand in southern Lebanon and holds seats in parliament. The Lebanese government has no control over Hezbollah, but has long resisted international pressure to forcibly disarm the group for fears of igniting sectarian conflict. Russia, the host of the Group of Eight summit, and France, another summit nation, have criticized the Israeli attacks. But Bush's strong defense for Israel has been tempered only by concern that the offensive could weaken or topple the fragile democratic government in Beirut. That's all the time we have for news today, though there's much more. Next, we move on to our in-depth look at issues between Israel and Palestine. We bring you this report from WBAI Sunday News on the UN-Palestinian protest. Over the past couple weeks, Israel has stepped up its military operations on the Gaza Strip, which is home to 1.4 million Palestinians, and arrested dozens, including 8 Hamas cabinet members and 20 members of parliament, in an attempt to force the release of an Israeli soldier kidnapped 2 weeks ago. Despite being urged to restraint by the Group of Eight industrialized nations, the Israeli military destroyed extensive civilian targets such as bridges, a power plant, and government buildings. The attacks also killed about 50 Palestinians by the time this protest occurred on July 6. On July 6, about 300 protesters lined the street across from the UN building in New York and sent a delegation to Secretary General Kofi Annan with a letter demanding sanctions against Israel and the immediate release of 8,000 Palestinian political prisoners, counting about 400 children. WBAI's Fred Nguyen recorded sound from the demonstration.
We just met with Vijay Nambiar, the special advisor to Secretary General Kofi Annan. We've gotten over 100 organizations from Palestine, from the U.S., Europe, and all around the world to sign the letter. We didn't expect to get an immediate release of the Palestinian prisoners being held in violation of international law. It was more or less as expected. New York has for far too long not been the center of resistance to the occupation, to Israeli apartheid over the Palestinians. But I think that's quickly changing. As people see the worst brutalities of the Israeli apartheid regime, I think we're going to get a lot more of such demonstrations. This is just the beginning.
My name is Riham Barghouti. I'm from the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions campaign. We call on all communities to carry out different forms of boycott, divestment, or sanctions, whatever is applicable. If it's church divestments, if it's individual boycott of Israeli products. And we're also here today to call on the international community to carry out sanctions against Israel's violations, not just of Palestinian human rights, but really violations of international law, including the International Court of Justice advisory ruling, over 60 UN resolutions. The boycott is happening internationally. In the UK, for example, the National Association of Teachers, which recently called for an academic boycott of Israeli academic institutions. You have in Belgium and in Canada different movements calling for boycott of Israeli products. You have a whole divestment campaign from the company Caterpillar, which supplies Israel with bulldozers that are used to demolish Palestinian homes. But internationally, there is a strong movement going, and we're hoping that we will start seeing results here in the U.S. as well. We've had the Presbyterian Church that has called for divestment, the Anglican Church, the Lutheran Church. So it's obvious that the time has come for action to take place.
Well, at this protest on July 6, 2006, Fred Nguyen for WBAI also recorded a short speech and a short interview with two Orthodox Jews against Zionism.
We have with us today a very important group that's always been very supportive, that believes in the right of the Palestinian state in historic Palestine for all its people. We are happy to welcome with us today Rabbi Feldman, who just wants to speak a few words. And we welcome you in all of our demonstrations and all of our actions, calling for a free Palestine for all its people. So please help me welcome Rabbi Feldman.
Thank you. I'm Rabbi Feldman with Neturei Karta International. It pains to see the relationship between Jews and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, has been destroyed. There was a nice history in the past where Jews and Arabs did live in peace. This is something that was destroyed by political Zionists. This has nothing to do with Jewish people and Judaism. We hope for the day and we pray that the state of Israel should be dismantled, and we hope it should be in peace. It shouldn't happen any more suffering for any Jews and Palestinians alike. And we pray and we hope that peace and coexistence should be restored as it was before. Thank you very much.
Hi. Who are you and what group are you representing here today?
My name is Rabbi Elchanan Kirshenbaum, and I'm representing Neturei Karta.
And where is your group based?
Basically, it has world branches, but it's based in the New York area, Williamsburg, Muncie, upstate.
And you are an Orthodox branch of Judaism?
Yes.
You have a particular viewpoint there. Can you describe to me? You have a group of perhaps 6 or 7 people here today protesting in favor of?
Actually, not in favor of, but for one thing, in opposition to the Israeli attacks on Gaza. And more in general, the point we're trying to make is that Zionism and the Zionist state is against the Jewish religion. And while they claim to be speaking in the name of the Jewish people, they do not represent true Orthodox Jews. Everything they do, all the injustices, the bombings, the murders, the oppression, is not in our name. So we are using this as an opportunity, besides for just protesting the present injustice, to make it known that the Zionist state does not represent true Jews.
Is this an opinion that is widespread in Orthodox Judaism, that Zionism is not really according to the Talmud?
Yes, just about all Orthodox Jews agree with that.
But yet there are Orthodox Jews who live in Israel, so is the fact that there is a state of Israel endorsed by certain branches of Orthodox Judaism?
Orthodox Jews have lived in Israel for hundreds of years, and they really don't care all that much who's running it. They're just living there and trying to lead their religious lives. Orthodox Jews do not endorse the state of Israel. There are, unfortunately, people who have came to terms with them as a practical matter, but no one will tell you that it is religiously legitimate. Some people have, unfortunately, tried to work things out with them more practically, and our stance is that no compromise, it's illegitimate, and therefore we have nothing to do with them.
Are there discussion on what potential solutions could exist for the land of Palestine, Israel, or the Middle East at this point among Orthodox Jews?
In the end, it's all in God's hands, and we don't have the power to actually implement a solution. But South Africa changed overnight. Soviet Russia disappeared overnight, and we're hoping that the same thing could happen in Israel.
You do not think that the state of Israel should exist?
No, I do not.
But you're not sure whether there should be also a state of Palestine?
You see that sign?
Sovereignty.
All Palestine under Palestinian sovereignty.
So all people should be there under a Palestinian state?
Yes. We would like to live there as loyal citizens to a Palestinian state.
So at this point, what are the activities of Orthodox Jews and how are they involved to try to defuse the situation? Because it puts some risk with Jewish lives and other people, and I'm sure they are concerned. So besides coming to a demonstration, and I've seen, you know, people of your group before, what are they involved in doing?
There is not all that much that we can do. We don't have political power. We are all praying to God, and we try to get the word out as much as possible by demonstrations, by taking out ads in the press and other things. Zionists do not represent the Jewish people. The true Jewish people are peace-loving, loyal citizens of whichever state they live in, including Palestine. We do not want to fight with anybody, and the Palestinian claims are justified, but their problem is not with us, it's specifically and only with the Zionists.
One last question. You stated that Jews should not have a state of their own and is based on biblical knowledge. Could you cite the passage?
This passage is in the Talmud. It's in Ksubas Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, page 111 in Ksubas.
Can you quote it? Which translates to?
Guard four swore the Jewish nation, that they should not go up in mass to the land of Israel. They should not rebel against the nations where they live. And they should not press for the end of their exile.
So living in America is okay?
Living in America is wonderful.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a nice day.
You're listening to Making Waves. And we now bring you this segment from Red Eye Co-op Radio of a talk given by Israeli mother Narut Peled Elhanan, who is calling for an end to the occupation of Palestine. Her 13-year-old daughter was killed by a Palestinian suicide bomber, and she lays the blame for her daughter's death on the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
This month of June is the anniversary of the 39th year of occupation. I'd like to dedicate my words to all the children who have and are being killed as I speak by the occupation forces. I would also like to dedicate my words to the mothers of these children who keep families in spite of the fact that they live in hell that neither you nor I can imagine. Mothers who hurry to make sandwiches when they see the bulldozer coming to destroy their houses. And last, I want to dedicate my words to my co-laureate of the Sakharov Prize, Professor Izzat Ghazawi, who was a writer and a poet, and who died of humiliation 2 years ago. Izzat Ghazawi lost his 15-year-old son in his schoolyard when his son rushed to help a wounded friend. Soldiers were shooting into the schoolyard. After that, he was arrested and put in solitary prison for 3 years without knowing why. When he was there, he decided to write a letter to an Israeli poet, and the letter was received by a deceased poet, Yair Horowitz, and together they founded a dialogue group of poets and writers that lasted 13 years. Before his death, he wrote to me that soldiers come every night to his house to harass him, break the furniture, and frighten the children. He asked me to go to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and ask them to stop it because he thought it was a mistake. And then he wrote, "I'm afraid they're trying to silence my voice." Well, his heart knew the truth and couldn't take it anymore, and he died. And I promised him that his voice would not be silenced. I want to say something about the title of this evening, No Peace Without Justice. It's a strange title. It seems argumentative, as if someone had offered peace without justice. Frankly, I have no idea what is peace, and I have no idea what is justice. I only know that the words peace and justice are cover words for the worst crimes against humanity that are carried on today all over the world. These cover words include also words such as freedom, democracy, God, and the good of the nation. In Israel now, politicians are organizing demonstrations in the south of the country against Qassam missile throwers. The incited people ask for justice in order to live in peace. This form of justice is this extermination of the Palestinians in Gaza. They convince the people in Shderot that the only way for them to live in peace is to have other people and their children massacred. I think that people like George Bush or Ehud Olmert or some Canadian leaders who send their soldiers to the other part of the world to kill children they don't even know live in peace because they think they are doing justice, at least to themselves. But the truth is that the only place where peace and justice prevail is in the underground kingdom of dead children. This is the only place in the world where everybody is equal, where nobody judges you by the piece of cloth you put on your head or by your circumcision. And these children, our children, make us, or at least make me, want to redefine the camps, redefine the word we. I think there's no other word in the world which is so ideologically charged like the word we. I was forced by death to ask myself this question when death put me in the camp of the victims of the occupation. But even before that, I never wanted to be in the camp of the executioners. And that means that in my camp, there are many more people with keffiyeh than with a kippah on their head. When Ehud Olmert, today our Prime Minister, came to pay condolences as the mayor of Jerusalem, I refused to see him or shake his hand. A reporter asked me, "How come you receive condolences from the other side?" And I told her very spontaneously, "I don't. I refuse to shake his hand. because for me this man was the other side, not my Palestinian friends. My we is defined by people who want to live in peace, by people who believe that children have rights and are not to be used as chips in the blood market of politicians. My we includes mothers whose motherhood has not been perverted, and that means mothers who do not send their children to kill other children, and mothers who do not feel consoled by the death of other mothers' children. And that means that it does not include Jewish mothers who live in the occupied territories. My we include the people from the Bereaved Families Forum who believe in dialogue and not in mind infection. And of course, the young people of the Young Movement Combatant for Peace who maintain an admirable dialogue between themselves. One of the projects of the forum, the Families Forum, is a project called Hello Peace, where you can dial a free number from either side and speak to people on the other side, Palestinians and Israelis. In the first 3 months of this project, there had been 800,000 minutes of talk. If our politicians, who set such a high price on every word they utter, but set no price at all on bullets, had spent half of it in talk, our children would have been alive today. Unfortunately, dialogue is a very strange praxis to the world today. Mind infection is much more common. Our children are mind infected. This is the only term that can explain how nice Jewish children, or nice American children, or nice British children become monsters once they are in uniform. Their mind infected into believing that killing other children and sacrificing themselves is for the good of the nation, or God, or freedom, or democracy. Israeli children learn that the population is divided into Jews and non-Jews. It doesn't matter who these non-Jews really are. Whatever they learn in history, in geography, even in science, is divided into Jews and non-Jews. Jewish agriculture versus non-Jewish agriculture. Jewish electricity versus non-Jewish electricity. Jewish water versus non-Jewish water. In no Israeli textbook is there one photograph of a Palestinian or any Arab as a human being, modern, productive, normal. The only representation of these people, who are neighbors, actually, is either by a racist caricature of the typical Arab from 1001 Nights, with pointed shoes, keffiyeh, and a camel, and a mustache, of course, or photographs of empty places where they tell you this is where the Palestinian problem matured and festered. Israeli textbooks call a whole nation a problem to be solved. And this is almost no more than 60 years after the Jews were called a problem to be solved. No map in any Israeli school book shows the international borders of the country. The international laws are taught to be inapplicable in our reality because we act according to divine laws. The children of Israel learn about the greater land of Israel and not about the state of Israel. The state of Israel is represented as an accident of a forced ceasefire and therefore as temporary. The Palestinian areas are incorporated into the state, but whenever there is a report about population, education, employment, etc., the legend of the map says about these areas an area without data, which means without people. When you have a map of Jerusalem, institutions, government, administration, religious sites, you never see any Muslim institution or religious site. This is part of the education that mind infects our children into believing that people who live 100 meters from them are not human beings, and that exterminating them is actually doing good for the nation, good for the Jews. All the massacres that are mentioned in textbooks, and there are a few, are rhetorically built in a way that in the end, you know, it was good for the nation. It is not very hard to educate people or to mind infect people not to see the other as a human being. I think it's far easier than to educate them to see other people as human beings. Last night when I came here, a young girl, officer in the, you know, passport inspection, yelled at me very rudely because I did not pronounce my working place in a way that she could understand. And I had to repeat 3 times, Tel Aviv University. She doesn't know what Tel Aviv University is, but she knows she has to be rude to people who come from outside. Mind infection and mental maps are very hard to erase. Racism is very easy to plant and very hard to uproot. Our children live immersed in a racist discourse which has no equal in what is called the enlightened world today, excuse me. Not only towards the Arabs. Racism does not stop at the checkpoints, but it goes on against Arab Jews, against so-called Jewish immigrants the Jewish Agency brings from overseas, Ethiopians, everyone against everyone. The election campaign in Israel a few months ago was worth of an election campaign in a fascist state. People on television may tell jokes about Arabs having sex with goats, about school violence being a Mideastern habit, about religious Jews in the most anti-Semitic way that is not permitted in any other country. This is the atmosphere our children grow up with. Our children who live, who reside under the earth, remind us that we have not done enough to eradicate racism. We have not done enough against mind infection. We've actually betrayed them because we promised them a better world and a good life. The only way for me to do them justice and maybe gain some peace for ourselves is to try to eradicate racism, bigotry, mind infection and blind loyalties, and to raise the voice of mothers. The voice of mothers is the most oppressed, suffocated voice in the history of men. Because the voice of mothers is the voice of dialogue and tolerance. In all our histories and mythologies, always, in a moment of crisis, there's a mother who defied the authorities, who deceived the king, the husband, or the father in order to save the children. That's why in the Jewish Talmud, they say that mothers are prophets. And the explanation is that they always knew what's best for their children, and they did whatever they could to achieve that. And I think this kind of motherhood is today dead or perverted to the point that mothers actually send their children to become soldiers of so-called leaders who have nothing but interest and profit for themselves in their mind, and serve them, as I said, as chips in the blood market. The only way we can help our children is to refuse them to cooperate with this, to refuse them for even by forsaking our relationships with them. Many mothers come to me and say, but my son is going to hate me if I don't let him go to the army. And I said, let him hate you for a year or two or five or ten. My own son, my both sons, my eldest sons, served in the army when the tragedy happened and they lost their sister. My eldest son, who was in an elite unit, which was his heart desire and his aspiration to the point that nobody could say anything, not even my father, who served in the army for 40 years and then dedicated himself to peace. My father was the first one to meet our chairman Arafat in Tunis with the help of his Palestinian friend Issam Sattawi, who was murdered for this friendship later on. Before he died, he implored my son Elik not to enlist and to go to the university instead. He told him that an army of peace needs educated officers. He didn't live to see the rest of it. And I told my son there, you have to lie to your grandfather because he's going to die. And we want him to die in peace. Nevertheless, he enlisted. And then he realized the futility. And not only the futility, but he realized, and he keeps saying that now and all the time when he speaks for the new movement, Combatants for Peace, he realized that indirectly he was the cause for his sister's death. His brother was just 1 month in the army, and he believed that by being a good soldier, he's going to save the whole world. Now, there is a very perverted law in Israel, which is famous for perverted laws, that in a bereaved families, the parents have to sign for the children an agreement if that they allow them to become fighting soldiers. And that means that they confront you with your children in such times. I refused to sign, and he was very depressed. And as we are the family that we are, I got a telephone call from the chief of staff. I was in London at the time, and he called me to London, and he said, "Lady, your little games cost us money. We invested in this boy." I told him his little games cost me much more. And then, in order to revenge or to get back at me, they transferred him from the elite unit where he was to a garage. There he met people he would never have met anywhere else, what is called in Israel the second Israel. Today, when he speaks, and he does all over Europe, about refusing, because he became refusnik after that, he says that my mother taught me to refuse by refusing me. And my days in the garage not only saved my life, but saved my human image. As for being a man, he wrote, this would come with the first child. This only to show you how difficult it is to erase mind defection. Because the children in Israel are so mind infected, they cannot even conceive if they are what we call people of value, not to contribute to their society. And the only way they are taught to contribute is to die a heroic death or kill in a heroic way, whatever that means. So our duty as mothers, I believe, is really to fight that, to stand in the way of our children and refuse them to cooperate with the forces of evil, namely with the democratic powers of what is called the enlightened world today. To help them to redefine themselves as human beings. And to help the world remember that the death of a child is the death of the whole world. One of the greatest Hebrew poets said, Satan has not yet invented the revenge for the blood of a small child. And this is not because Satan has no imagination. It is because after the death of a child, there is no other death, and there is no other life, and there is no revenge. The child takes with its small body and its small bones, the war, its causes, and its consequences. We are here, I believe, to remind the world that all the historic processes and all the international discussions, which have not yet saved one child from death, neither the European Parliament nor the Vatican nor the UN, nor the Nobel Prize Committee, who rewards ex-murderers every year instead of rewarding persevering mothers, have not saved one child from death. And we are here to remind the world that all these big people and big discussions and big money and big words are finally reduced to the small body of the little girl in her new uniform and her new school bag lying in the dust in Gaza, her little body pierced with as many bullets as protocol allows. And we are to remind the world of the question asked by the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova, who also lost her child to a ruthless regime. Why does this streak of blood rip the petal of your cheek. Thank you.
That was Nurit Peled Elhanan, an Israeli mother calling for an end to the occupation in the name of her 13-year-old daughter, who was killed by a Palestinian suicide bomber. This is David Rovix with Occupation.
You ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself, pointing out you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other is the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For the one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army, ruling by decrees. Caterpillars maul the streets, destroy whole city blocks, while children swallow shrapnel for the crime of throwing rocks. Fences are erected around the towns they flatten, and Herzl's own fanatics sleep on sheets of satin. And they water their plantations, drilling ever deeper wells, while the displaced children of the hopeless are filled with bullet shells. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the settlers return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there's the Mossad, rounding up the men, thrown in jail with no trial, being tortured once again. On the other there is rage, helplessness and fear, and a growing realization that another Holocaust is near. On the outside there are prisons, the inside detainees, being stripped of their humanity, beaten naked to their knees. Outside the ghetto walls, stormtroopers all around, while inside the hungry people yearn for liberated ground. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the jail guards return to Tel Aviv. Say the children of Jerusalem will be free one day. In overcrowded camps amidst the stench of death and flies, to the suburbs of Detroit you can hear the anguish cries. While in the land of Israel, with God ever on their side, walls and fences are constructed, papers are denied. People fight for their existence while we turn a blinded eye, and those who should know better insist on asking why. The word you need to know is occupation, very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It will come on the day the refugees return to Tel Aviv.
That was David Rovix with Occupation. You're listening to Making Waves. And we now bring you Steve Diamond with his commentary.
More invasions against violence. The U.S. and Israel are willing to grasp onto even the slightest excuses for invading and occupying new areas. Israel has invaded and reoccupied northern Gaza and abducted dozens of Palestinian government representatives, all supposedly because one Israeli military officer remains missing, and the democratically elected Hamas government refuses to unilaterally renounce violence. It is uncertain if Hamas is even capable of arranging the release of the soldier by whatever faction is holding him. Yet 40 Palestinians have already been killed in this military action, and that could be just the beginning. This is the sort of fairness and justice a prison warden inflicts on his inmates. As former Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu once said, "The source of terror is hope." The Israeli government sees peace as the fruition of absolute military domination and imprisonment of the Palestinians, where the Palestinian people are expected to lose all hope that they can ever have any rights, self-rule, or future not subject to Israel's veto. The prison metaphor is not hyperbole. Here in the U.S., I've met only about 30 people who, like myself, have been arrested and held indefinitely simply for walking down the street or participating in a peaceful protest. Yet in the lifetime of a typical Palestinian, they may only ever meet about 30 people who have not experienced this for themselves. Due to the maze of concrete walls, razor wire, and Israeli checkpoints throughout Palestinian territory, many spend their entire lives within 10 miles of where they were born. Collective punishment, indefinite detention, racist home demolition, and assassination of Palestinian leaders are Israel's standard policies and daily atrocities that much of the world community never hears about or chooses to ignore. And that's not even the only recent military invasion we've been told is against violence and to ensure that those already killed, for a lie, didn't die in vain. U.S. troops have recently launched an assault on the vast Shiite slum of Sadr City in Baghdad, supposedly just to capture a so-called insurgent named Abu Dira, a commander in Iraq's largest Shiite militia. Since Sadr's party is an important part of the Iraqi government, remind me again exactly who are the freedom fighters and who is fighting to destroy freedom? Saying insurgent implies that mostly foreign agitators are trying to destabilize the legitimate Iraqi government. Yet the fact is, the Iraqi resistance to U.S. occupation is popular and native, and there's nothing legitimate about an Iraqi government whose every policy is subject to American veto. About three-quarters of the Iraqi resistance just promised to stop fighting if the U.S. would commit to withdraw from Iraq in 2 years. Even though setting some sort of a timetable for U.S. withdrawal is supported by the Iraqi people, many U.S. lawmakers, and two-thirds of the American population, according to a recent poll, the puppets in Baghdad and Washington insist we can't be sure Iraq's proxy U.S. army will be ready to take over for us by then, so no deal. Once again, absolute military domination is presented as the only acceptable peace, where U.S. plutocrats plan to dictate the economic policies needed to finance their continued global rule into the future. This is the real cause for which over 2,500 U.S. soldiers and countless Iraqis have already died. The dead soldier card. On July 4th, President Bush promised the nation's men and women in uniform he would not allow, quote, the sacrifice of 2,527 troops who have died in Iraq to be in vain by pulling out before the job is done. I bet some Nixon administration official said something similar at 2,500, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000, 30,000, and 45,000 U.S. casualties in Indochina. On January 23, 1973, Richard Nixon delivered a speech where he said, quote, I would like to say a word to some of the bravest people I have ever met, the wives, the children, the families of our prisoners of war and the missing in action. When others called on us to settle on any terms, you had the courage to stand for the right kind of peace so that those who died and those who suffered would not have died and suffered in vain, and so that, where this generation knew war, the next generation would know peace. We have not known peace, just the same old tired rhetoric used to justify endless wars when the latest ghastly policies obliterate all the ideals that supposedly brought us to that point. Both sides of the story. Career politicians stage high drama between nearly identical strategies of empire that we are supposed to get behind and debate with a misplaced sense of gravity. It's the politics of yelling liar, liar, scaredy cat, and mama's boy, except the sandbox for these choir boys is the Middle East, where we show our do as I say, not as I do, and shock at gambling at Rick's Cafe attitudes towards weapons of mass destruction. We're supposed to seriously believe they've actually found the massive stockpiles of illegal weapons poised to destroy the American way of life and addiction to consumption. All we had to do was look at the receipt. Consecutive U.S. presidents kept sending that dictator military resources, including chemical weapons stocks, for year after year. The CIA had earlier overthrown the inadequately pliant Mossadegh democracy in Iraq. Yet somehow, the highly educated Iraqi people will forget all that so we can win their hearts and minds and get our troops the hell out of harm's way. will just compensate with massive aerial bombardment to reduce U.S. casualties and pacify the American voters, along with the Iraqi countryside, into accepting as inevitable permanent U.S. military occupation. What a relief some decaying old remnants of chemical weapons were found in Iraq, just in time for us to permanently forget the professed ideals behind Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Iraqi Liberation. Their purpose is long expired, like the latest, but certainly not last, strongman ruling Iraq. A look at all possible outcomes in Iraq can only overwhelm us with the enduring stench of the allegedly Republican and Democratic parties. The flagrant inability of Congress to check and balance the power of our president shows that our global policy karma has come home, and we've witnessed a silent military coup to place another strongman to rule us all. You can find that column with relevant links at nhindymedia.org. On the right bar is Between Iraq and a Hard Place. That column was called More Invasions Against Violence. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.